Hey guys.
Hey.
So this week we are going to just jump right into Ash's story.
Yes.
About a relationship.
About a relationship. And if you have stories about a relationship, you can email us at shotofcrime@gmail.com.
If you're having relationship issues, we'll give your advice. Send us an email.
Maybe you're being ghosted like we are by you currently.
Oh yikes. So send it to us. shotofcrime@gmail.com.
Yes. Okay. So my story is about Susan Powell. Have you heard this story?
Nope. Never heard of her name. Although you did talk about a Susan recently, but it's not this Susan, right?
No. So this is a pretty big case. There's podcasts and like ABC specials on it. So, really easy to find information. Those are basically the two sources I have for this. So she was not an unassuming victim. She spent hours moving through the home she lived in with her husband, Josh, and sons, Charlie and Brayden, documenting things she planned to take with her after she filed for divorce and making frequent comments of concern for her safety.
Oh, gosh.
So a little backstory on Susan. She loved riding horses, singing in her church choir, and spending time with friends. She went to cosmetology school and was very into fashion and hair and, quote, liked to make other people feel good about themselves, end quote. She and Josh Powell met in a small town called Puyallup, Washington.
That's a cool name.
Fun, yeah.
I have never heard of that.
When she was 18 and he was in his 20s. They were at a social event for young Mormons. This was one of her first experiences in a relationship. So she was kind of young, naive. Perfect circumstance. Josh was said to be ambitious, stubborn, and outgoing. He was assertive and knew exactly what he wanted. So much so that they started dating or getting to know each other technically in early October and were engaged by December. They were married in April of 2001. Footage from their wedding reveals a happy Susan dancing around and giddy. As you watch Josh, he seems to give her the cold shoulder multiple times.
Oof, on their wedding day?
Yeah, and she's left over and over to talk to guests by herself while he disappeared and was playing with cameras and talking to his family, just ignoring her.
That's messed up.
While there was affection in the beginning, it would later come to light that Susan shared struggles with friends of how over time he didn't want to touch her, he refused to kiss her, and wasn't interested in her at all sexually.
That's so
she
sad.
Was like obviously in love with him, very attracted to him, whatever, and he was just not into it.
That's sad.
Susan and Josh did not have a lot of income at their disposal. She worked as a hairdresser, then worked at a bank, and was the financial provider for their family.
Oh, shoot. With Josh bringing the bread.
Yeah, Josh went in and out of odd jobs and never landed on something that lasted like a long time. He kind of so he wouldn't just jump from job to job. He would like get a job,
quit.
It wouldn't last. He would be unemployed, get a job, it wouldn't last. So he was very,
Red signs here.
Red signs.
Red flags.
The couple moved to West Valley City in Utah to pursue a better life. They bought a home and started a family, having their first son, Charlie. Susan dreamt of being a mom while Josh was described as an unattached dad.
Oh, man.
His kids seemed more like extensions of himself than individuals he loved and cared for, which is one of the attributes of a narcissist. You have moments that come across as caring for your kids, but it's just because of what they're doing for you or how they make you look. It's not at all because you actually care for these people. Because if you're really a narcissist, you're kind of incapable of caring. So he kind of displays many attributes of that. Josh had no interest in fatherly duties or helping Susan care for their sons. Soon they had their second son, Brayden. While she was the sole long-term provider for the family, Josh controlled where all of their assets went.
Ugh, that's so annoying.
Yep. He spent his money on computers and printers and gadgets, and every penny she spent had to be approved by him.
That's
sounds like the life, huh?
I can literally imagine this couple.
And oh, yeah.
Who he is.
And she's like trying to get affirmation from him still, and he's still withholding for whatever reason. It's just their relationship hit rock bottom in 2008. According to those close to Susan, no intimacy and constant fights led to Susan shoving him pushing her back and saying, quote, If you ever do that again, I will hit you. Ooh, end quote.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah. That's what led to Susan seeking a divorce. He warned her that if she divorced him, she would never see her children again, which we know, especially since she's the stable income.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be the case. But when you're in that situation,
you're just scared.
You're scared.
And if he's gotten used to getting everything he wants, like she might be thinking, oh, he's going to find a way.
Also, that's a veiled threat of maybe something will happen to you and you won't see them again, or maybe something will happen to them. So I feel like it's just, it's easy to look at and be like, well, of course she wouldn't never see them again, but you understand why she was scared by that. On December 7th, 2009 at 7 a.m., the daycare provider for the boys was surprised when Susan didn't show up with the boys.
Oh gosh.
She knew Susan had to be at work at 7 and it wasn't like her to be late and not call. As an active snowstorm was in occurrence, the daycare worker grew concerned and drove to Susan's home. The first thing she observed was that there were no tire tracks in the snow, so she hadn't left recently because there would be signs of that. She knocked and no one answered. She called the boys' emergency contacts, which were Josh's sister, Jennifer, and his mother, Terry. What first came to mind was carbon monoxide poisoning. That was the main concern. They called the police, who arrived for a welfare check. They then asked if the family would pay for the window if they broke it to enter the home. And of course they agreed.
Yeah.
Here's what they found in the home. Two box fans face down, pointed at the carpet in the family room, presumably to dry it.
That's weird.
Dry the floor. I don't know if they were on or not at that time, but they were just kind of in a weird position.
Do fans work when they're like,
I think they would dry the surface directly underneath it if they were on like that, but it would be a slow process because you're kind of like stalling the mechanism. Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's not really how
that's
it works.
What I was thinking.
But it would probably work better than just letting it air dry.
Yeah. And that's like that's weird because you're also just trying to dry something fast. Like, what are you drying?
Yeah, it's just a weird circumstance. So no one was in the home. Their minivan was not in the garage, which is where they kind of had assumed it was.
Mm-hmm.
Susan's purse containing her keys and wallet was in the home.
Did they only have one car?
I think so. So I did have that thought because there's times when it's like, okay, Susan has to be here because the van's here. And it doesn't really talk. It talks about Josh taking the van at certain points, but then he says like he's with the kids taking them somewhere and he's like, oh, Susan was going here. So I don't know if there was a second vehicle
or she was,
they
just
don't
like
really talk about
somewhere.
It. Right. Okay. The house is pretty clean, but the boys' beds were stripped of their blankets, which were nowhere to be found. There was no sign of a physical altercation, just the fans. That was a little strange. The family was missing their loved ones and feared they had gone for a drive and gotten caught in the snowstorm. The night before, Josh, who took an old-fashioned approach to spousal roles, chose to cook dinner with the boys while Susan and her neighbor crocheted. So this is an account from the neighbor saying, I was over, I was crocheting. Josh, out of nowhere, he doesn't ever do this, said, I'll make dinner.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. This doesn't seem like something that he would do.
No. He wasn't really like the,
let me serve you.
Yeah, no. He brought the women pancakes on an individual plate. So he brought them to his wife. He brought them to the neighbor in the family room and ate with the boys in the kitchen. So in a separate room. This was very different from their normal routine, and normally a routine change wouldn't matter that much, but they were very much a family of structure, so this was strange. Soon, Susan said she wasn't feeling well and wanted to lay down.
Uh-oh, what did he put in her pancake?
Right. Josh said he was going to take the boys sledding. So basically what happens here is the neighbor's there, Susan's like, I'm tired, I want to lay down. And the neighbor gets up to leave. And as she's walking out the door, he says, I'm going to take the boys sledding. This is all according to the neighbor. So they're kind of like, he's kind of rushing her out the door too,
weird.
But then getting in the car with the boys and leaving. And she's
but
like,
also like, if your wife isn't feeling well, it's like, let me just leave. Like, I don't know. It's kind of weird.
I don't know. Strange. 24 hours after the Powells were thought to be missing, Josh called his family. So obviously they brought up Susan. He was like, I don't know what happened. The boys are with me. I have no idea what happened to her. And he says she went to work. So that's the thing. He has the van with him.
Yeah.
And
how
the boys.
Did she,
I don't know.
I don't know. Public transportation.
A friend, a coworker. Yeah. I don't know. It never really addresses that kind of blind spot in it. Josh had gone to Point of the Mountain and called and left a voicemail for Susan saying he and the boys were on the way back and he mixed up the days and thought it was Sunday. Mm. It was Monday. And he ended it by saying, all right, talk to you later. Bye. So not very warm and affectionate. The other thing to note here is when you're super religious, you know what day it is when it pertains to Sunday. You know when it's Sunday.
Especially Mormons are very strictly like, they're there. They're at church every Sunday.
Yeah. You know when it's Sunday, you know when it's Monday. Yeah. Like you don't really get those days confused, barring some kind of like coronavirus where everything shut down or like holiday or whatever. You know when it's Sunday. So it's a little weird. I have heard some stuff of they were kind of slipping away from the church. So maybe they were kind of like pulling back from it. So maybe they had already stopped at this point. I'm not sure. It doesn't really say that.
Okay.
An hour after calling, Josh showed up at the home. He said he had taken the kids on a middle of the night camping trip in the snow with a snowstorm hitting in the morning. He said while Susan was sleeping, he and the boys spontaneously decided on the trip.
That's weird as heck.
According to him, the last time he saw Susan was at midnight after they finished up a movie. When asked what they watched, he said, and trailed off talking to one of his sons. So you'll hear in the audio, they ask him, one of his sons kind of says something, but it's not something that requires his attention. And he's like, and then just starts talking to the kid and just ignores it.
But also, the last time you saw her was midnight. So you woke up at, like, not woke up, but like after a late movie, it's midnight and you decide, let me just take my kids and go on a trip.
If what the neighbor said is true, you went sledding with the boys while she slept. She woke up, you guys watched the movie, and then you went out again.
That's weird. And by midnight, your kids would have already been sleeping. So you like woke them up.
Yeah. So that's not, he even says like he woke the boys up.
That's weird. Who does that?
It's kind of him though.
That's so weird.
He's known to do weird stuff like that. Josh says they drove to Simpson Springs and had s'mores by a fire, but was vague about any other details. The police asked him if they could search his minivan, and he agreed. The minivan was full of camping supplies, which included gloves, a shovel, and tarps. So that sounds weird. At first when I read that, I was like, that's really creepy. I don't like that.
But camping?
Camping in the snow is different. I'm coming from camping in Florida. You would never need any of those things, really. I mean, maybe a tarp to put stuff on. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like some people do. A lot of people do that.
You could probably, I'm not a huge camper, so you could probably justify those things. But it is weird in this context. You're kind of like, so if that strikes you as odd, probably not as odd as you think it is.
Yeah.
During the search, they found Susan's phone hidden in the middle console of the minivan. So when they found this, sure, whatever, she may have left it in there. Whatever. Weird that he called it, didn't hear it ring.
Yeah.
Because it was on.
Unless he was outside of the car. Was he outside of the car?
He was driving home when he called
her. Oh, got it.
Yeah, that's weird. Also, his reaction when they found it, he was a deer in headlights and acted
super
weird.
He's like, oh, shoot, I forgot.
Which it's like, they're searching your minivan. You know they're going to find that. I don't know.
I think he forgot. That's probably why he was shocked.
Maybe. I don't know. It's like, you're going to go through the trouble to call her and do all the stuff and forget. I don't know. Maybe he thought he grabbed it out. So the discovery of Susan's phone was striking, but with no physical evidence, it was determined the investigators still did not have enough probable cause to secure a search warrant for the Powell residence or book Josh.
That's annoying.
While detectives were busy jumping through hoops, Josh burned a metal object that was so destroyed no one could detect what it was. So they found like burned up metal object. And tons of bags of trash were added to the trash that very night.
Oh my gosh, that's so suspicious.
The next day, he completely detailed and cleaned the van and did all of the laundry in the home before coming to meet with the police.
I know that you can't use that as evidence, but like, that's somebody who's like suspicious.
Don't be suspicious.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say to like play devil's advocate is sometimes when I'm really stressed about something happening or like, I'm like anxious about something, like I'm cleaning, like I'm just doing something. So he could be that kind of thing, but I don't think that's the case.
So like my whole logic that I apply to this is if my husband was missing, I wouldn't be in the house.
Yeah.
Like I would be searching for him.
Yeah.
I couldn't just sit there and do laundry or do whatever, like clean the van. Like, no,
that's
I'm
just weird.
Looking like I don't care about any of that stuff.
But he doesn't seem like he's the type of person that would be like care about doing laundry and things like that. So it's definitely weird.
Yeah, I don't know. Strange.
But I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he's not out looking for her, even if he didn't do something to her, because it didn't seem like he really liked her. Like, that doesn't right. surprise me.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not surprising, but it doesn't look good.
No.
In the interview tape, you see him acting very emotional, and it's not super convincing. Like, it's bad acting.
Yep.
As the detective pushes him for more information, his demeanor changes to detached and cold. He seems indifferent to find her. When asked if he had looked for her at all, he said he hadn't had time.
What do you mean? Which but is you like had you, time to do all this other stuff.
Yeah. He didn't ask anything about their investigation. So have you found anything? Do you know anything? Is there any suspects?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Weird.
The interview escalates as the detectives say, quote, "Let me ask you one more question," end quote. And Josh says, quote, "Go ahead, one more question," end quote.
I'm sorry, you're not running this.
Yeah, he thinks he's running it. To which the investigator replies, quote, "How am I going to find your wife without your help?" And Josh did not respond.
For real?
While Josh was being interviewed, Charlie was being interviewed, his son. Buddy. Charlie was 4, and he said that he was camping with his dad, mom, and his little brother.
Oh, come on.
He said his mom was in the van but didn't come back with them. He also said she stayed at the Dinosaur National Park. He said, quote, "Mommy is with the crystals," end quote.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
He freaking did. He buried her somewhere.
Maybe one of you guys can look up. I don't know if there's like crystals in Dinosaur Park, if that's a place, what the deal is with that.
That makes sense though, because if there is a dinosaur park, it's like I don't doubt it. There's like, you know, like you're mining for crystals. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
I don't think as a 4-year-old you would forget that your mom wasn't on like a trip like that. It's not like you're just going to the store. Like a 4-year-old may not remember like if their mom or dad joined the other parent at a store. But yeah. Like going camping, like you would remember that.
Yep.
And that's not that like far after.
Yeah. I think kids have a better memory than we give them credit for.
Yes. Yeah.
I think their memory can be manipulated.
Yes. That's
especially
true.
Especially when you're older and you're hearing stories.
That's true.
Absolutely. But as like close proximity to that, I think yeah. that it's probably a better, more solid memory than most adults.
Yeah.
Cause they're much more honest about what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
The detectives told Josh that what Charlie said, and he became irritated and called his kids, quote, liars.
Of course he did.
He then requested a lawyer. Detectives put a tracker on his vehicle, and in what seemed to be an act of preservation, he rented a vehicle and disappeared for 18
oh
hours.
Oh my gosh.
So it's almost like he knew they put a tracker, but he disappeared for 18 hours. He put an additional 807 miles on the rental, and no one knows where he went.
How far was the place that they went camping?
I'm not sure. It was Simpson Park.
I'm wondering if the math would make sense if he like went back there, did something. Like, I don't know.
Okay, so I feel like they would probably say that if that was around the same distance.
Mm-hmm. So you just
so I doubt
random.
That. I think it was probably much further than the parks that he went to that night. But he could have gone like there and then somewhere else. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
As we talked about earlier, Susan's friend said there were issues in the marriage and she went to see a divorce lawyer who encouraged her to video document her belongings. Volunteers had handed out flyers about Susan and tried to find her. Her friends held a candlelight vigil, which Josh showed up too late with his sons, said nothing, and then left as soon as people started asking questions.
Not surprised.
Looks suspicious, but also if your spouse is missing and you're getting asked a bunch of questions, you would probably leave too.
Especially if you have your
kids
with you.
That's not that crazy to me, yeah.
Yeah.
I would probably be organizing the vigil. Like,
yeah.
You would think that people would be more involved, but people react different.
Yeah.
Where am I? Susan kept a secret safety deposit box at the bank where she worked.
Smart.
When police discovered it, they found a letter front and back going into detail about how bad the marriage was, how Josh took out a life insurance policy on her, and how she would never willingly leave her son. So she explicitly says, "I would not leave my sons
That's
willingly."
That's so smart. Mm-hmm. Wow. She really thought ahead. Like, she was very convinced that something was going to happen to her.
Well, he's probably threatened her many times.
Yeah.
Josh was not arrested due to the DA refusing to do anything as long as there wasn't a body.
I get that.
It's a tough situation. Yeah. I do feel like there's enough to at least get a warrant to search the home and stuff. But arresting him is a little bit harder to make a case for. Within days of her disappearance, he closed their bank account, emptied their house, and took the boys on a trip to his dad, Steven's house.
Hmm.
Police were focusing their search near the campsite Josh claimed to take the boys. Obviously. Someone Josh had worked with in the past came forward claiming Josh said the best place to bury a body would be a mine.
What the heck?
He's not wrong. That is a really good place
to
bury a
body. But why would you just like casually say that to a coworker, especially with the past that you have? Like, oh no.
Yeah.
Okay. No. Yeah. This man absolutely did something to his wife.
Steven, Josh's father, shielded Josh and allowed him to stay at his house. They resisted the media and investigation at first. Jennifer, Josh's sister, volunteered to wear a wire and attempt to elicit a confession out of Josh. So she's completely on Susan's side. Never really liked
good
her family. Kind of sees the negative aspects of them.
Yeah.
On Charlie's birthday, she went to her father's house and confronted him. She grew frustrated when he wouldn't talk to her, so she took him into the bathroom to get him away from the protection of their father.
Oh, gosh. Because
Steven just kept interjecting and like...
Is he just defending him?
So she was like, come here, we're talking. So she directly asked, where's Susan's body? Why are you trying to cover it up? And she encouraged him to confess. And he said, he was just saying, don't be ridiculous. I don't know anything. You're being ridiculous. He didn't give her anything to go off of. And Steven kicked her out, calling her an effing.
Oh my gosh.
Susan's parents went to the media to call Josh out. They said he had no valid explanation for where he was. While they did this, he isolated himself in Steven's home for 18 months.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. Susan's friends organized a honk and wave near a neighborhood store. Josh and his father frequented. So they go there a lot. They decided to strategically put this here.
Mm-hmm.
I get the logic of it.
Yeah, for real.
They're holding up posters and handing out flyers there. Steven soon showed up and said it was a store he shopped at and was upset that they were handing things out near his residence.
Are you not wanting your daughter-in-law to be found?
He was filmed very upset they were doing this near his home and confronted them about, quote, attacking Josh.
This is about her being found and not about you.
Josh then showed up with the boys and said he was being targeted. So they both kind of show up aggressive. It doesn't look good for them.
Yeah, you're just being defensive.
Not a good move. Josh then agreed to an interview with ABC on April 24th, 2011.
Hmm.
The interviewer believed she was in the presence of a killer.
Oh, gosh.
He was asked if he still loved her and said, yeah, with forced emotion.
Oh.
He said people who knew him know he's a good dad and was a good husband.
Was a good husband.
And provided for them. And said Susan also, quote, contributed.
No, you did not.
She was literally the sole provider.
Heck no.
She asked about the camping trip. So the interviewer asked about the camping trip. Mm-hmm. He said his lawyer wouldn't allow him to answer where he was.
Okay.
Very diplomatic. Something else to be noted in this story is Susan's father-in-law, Steven. He loved to film family moments and documented much of Susan and Josh in the beginning of their relationship up until the end. Okay. These videos would later be released by police as they uncovered Steven's creepy obsession with her.
Oh, my gosh.
During this very ABC interview, Steven was there and can be heard eager to be interviewed himself. So he's kind of interjecting, speaking
for... So we got two narcissists over here.
Oh, yes.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah. So they finally were like... the way they talk about it is so funny. They're like, obviously he wanted to talk to us, so we sat him down.
But it's literally like giving a toddler attention after
but
like a
temper
tantrum.
But it's good because you don't know what he's going to say.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So you it's just annoying to, because you know that he's like thriving off of it.
Yeah. So this is when Steven, the father, claimed that Susan ran away with another man.
Okay.
He called her overly flirtatious with him specifically and admitted they had a sexual relationship
in
this interview.
What the heck?
But he said it as if it would make her look bad and not thinking about how it makes him look.
Does Josh know this at this point?
Yeah, I think Josh is just there like, I don't think he cares.
Oh my gosh.
He said... One day he was holding Brayden and he claimed Susan came up to take Brayden and pressed her breast against his hand and wouldn't let them out. He said it was nice because it was a cold day.
Oh no. Heck no. Heck no. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
That's disgusting.
During their marriage, they lived for a short period of time with Steven. So the whole family was up in
miserable
there.
For her.
And Steven wrote a song for his daughter-in-law with the lyrics, I can love you in a secret way.
No, absolutely not.
It's so creepy, guys. Ew. If you want to look it up, like, it is so... I'm trying to think of a vocalist to compare it to, but it is just so creepy.
That's gross.
Stephen recorded a conversation. He was riding in the car with Susan, and he admitted he was in love with her. So he filmed a lot of stuff, but this was where it was hidden, so you just hear the voices. You don't see her reaction. That's
weird. Why would you do that?
She immediately rejected him. She said she had been meaning to talk to him about how uncomfortable his advances made her. When she brought all this up, Josh said this was just her dad. So she brought it up to Josh, and he was like, that's just how my dad is. Whatever. Just get over it.
Ew. Yep. That's so gross.
So at this point in the story and in the investigation, Josh and Steven decided it would be a great idea to turn over Susan's private diary. Multiple, actually. So diaries. With the goal of making her, pointing to her, like, being promiscuous, basically. Like, look at her diary. She talks about this. And she did talk about being lonely in her relationship and, like, crushes she had on other people. But that wasn't the main thing in her diaries that police focused on.
Uh-oh.
Now focus shifted from Josh to Steven because they had reason to believe he was stalking her. The police then raided Steven's home and retrieved cameras and computers. They found footage Steven had taken of sliding mirrors under doors while Susan was in the bathroom. So he's filming all this. Touching her underwear and saying out loud he loved putting it against his face.
What is this guy?
Her garbage that he kept for himself. He had organized it in Ziploc bags, cotton swabs, tampons, tissues,
that's
all
weird
of her
as
trash.
Heck. That is
and he
so
had it neatly
weird.
Organized.
Ugh, that's disgusting.
In his walk-in closet, there was a filing cabinet that was locked. Once they opened it, inside, there were images of young girls being videotaped while bathing. So it was the neighbor's house. They were aged 7 and 10, and they were filmed from Steven's bedroom window.
That's disgusting.
At this point, so he did have an alibi for the night Susan went missing, so they know he didn't do that. But at this point now, it's a whole separate thing.
Yeah.
In legal proceedings, they focused on voyeurism and child pornography. And he was charged with 5 years in prison.
Ew.
So at this point, they wanted to interview the boys again. And this had been a couple years later. So Brayden drew a picture of the minivan with stick people inside. So they just let him draw.
Brayden was the younger one.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, he's like, what, four
it
now?
It doesn't say how old he is at this point. But yeah, it was like 1 or 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Is like 19, 20 months later. So yeah, almost 2 years later.
Okay.
So he's drawing this minivan of stick people, and then they ask him to say, like, hey, who's in the picture? So he says, that's my dad, that's my mom, in the trunk. So he drew a stick person in the trunk
and said, that's
my mom in the trunk. It's all on camera.
What the heck? Okay, but honestly, do we trust him? It's weird. It's definitely weird.
Well, it's just weird to come up with on your own.
But
and this
as,
is
a, Brayden, as a kid that young...
As a kid that young, like...
If he was, like, one or two...
Well, he would definitely be two at that point when everything happened. But also something strange like that...
Wait, you said he was two when it happened?
Yes, Charlie was four. I think he was, like, 2 years younger. So
okay,
he was, like, two. But I do think you can... You don't necessarily have long-term memory with everything, but something that's out of the norm like that... Like, why is mom in the trunk? Might stick out to you. Or Charlie might have talked to him and be like, mom was in the trunk. That's weird.
Yeah.
I don't know how it happened, but they didn't, basically they didn't conjure that out of him. He just said it.
Yeah.
Which is weird. And then Charlie said the only way he would ever be able to see his mom again is if they went camping.
Oh my gosh.
And then Charlie said he didn't know where she was and she just got lost somewhere. And he said, I can't talk about Susan or camping.
What the heck?
And then he said, I always keep things as secrets.
Oh.
So they at this point felt like Charlie had been kind of coached by his dad and his
like
dad's
scared.
Family of like, don't talk about this at all. So he's giving a little bit of information, but it seems like he's been told, like, don't talk because he was very open in the first interview. So Susan's family, who were the Cox, they were the Cox family, Coxes, I guess, fought for full custody while they had temporary custody of the boys. So that was legal proceedings going on. And Josh was allowed visitation, which is supposed to be at a third-party location with supervision of a social worker. So at this point, Josh rented a new house, and he pushed the social worker to move visitation to his new home. He's like, just please come to me. Like, they'll feel more comfortable in my house. And the boys even, they wanted to go to dad's house. Chuck, which was Susan's dad, was surprised when the boys told him that they were getting to go to their father's house. And mm-hmm. he grew concerned because that wasn't really the plan. The boys were excited. They got to see their dad and they visited him from December to January at his home. In February, Josh had the custody hearing to find out if he would get the boys back. And he went into it kind of cocky and like...
Oh, of course he did.
He definitely thought he was getting it. The police working in Susan's case were so concerned about Charlie and Brayden being in Josh's care, they passed along unreleased evidence to the court.
Oh, shoot.
And this is kind of a weird thing that's... It's going to feel very out of left field, but it was enough for it to be... them to send it to the courts. So they uncovered this at Josh's home, the Powell home, and there were images found on his computer in 2009 of Nickelodeon cartoon characters, and they were engaged in incestuous sexual acts.
Ew, why are these people so weird?
It said it wasn't necessarily malicious, but it was just like, weird. This is concerning. Yeah.
Who brought that up? Like, hey, whatever we could do to get these boys not...
And they probably found that we're like, what the heck?
That's so weird.
So if you look at stuff like that, that can come back to haunt you. Be careful.
Just don't be weird like that.
This raised enough questions about Josh being a sufficient father to the boys, because clearly he had some weird things going on. Mm-hmm. And the judge ruled the boys would remain in the Susan's parents' home. Josh was ordered to undergo a psychosexual evaluation. Okay. This exam not only measures what arouses a person, so they literally they will show images and things and see what arouses you. But it's also a form. Imagine taking that test, like, the wind blows the wrong way, and you're like, oh my god, no. sorry, this is unfortunate. So it's also a form of a lie detector test. So they would be permitted to ask questions about Susan while doing all of this.
Oh gosh, which that's he had been able.
So he was able to not agree to a lie detector test, but now he's being ordered by the court to do this test, and they can work in.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So Josh, at this point, he found out this had to happen, and he kind of reached a breaking point. He went home, he donated almost all of the boys' belongings, and he started panicking. On February 5th, 2012, the boys went to Josh's for their regular visit that they had. Mm-hmm. They were picked up by a social worker from, Susan's parents' house. And upon arrival to Josh's house, the boys walked into the home and Josh gave the social worker a cold stare and slammed the door in her face. He locked it before she could go inside. The social worker then banged on the door, rang the doorbell, and heard Josh say, quote, Charlie, I've got a surprise for you, end quote. She then started to smell gasoline. The social worker immediately called 911, and here's how the conversation went. This is going to be kind of lengthy, but I promise you it's important.
I'm scared. I don't want to know.
Okay. I'm going to have to say these things a million times, but 911 operator, what's the address? Social worker. It's 8119, and I think it's 89th. I don't know what the address is. Operator. Okay, that's pretty important for me to know. Social worker. I'm sorry, just a minute. Let me get in my car and see what I can find. Nothing like this has ever happened before, and these visitations... So, I'm really shocked, and I can hear one of the kids crying.
No.
But he still won't let me in. Okay, it's 1-1... Oh, just a minute. I have it here. You can't find me by GPS? Operator, no. Social worker, okay, it is, I still can't find it, but I think I need help right away. He's on a very short lease with DSHS, and CPS has been involved. And this is the craziest thing. He looked right at me and closed the door. Are you there? Operator, yes, ma'am, I'm just waiting to know where you are. Worker, okay, it's 8199 189th Street, Court East, Puyallup, 98375. We can beep some of that out because I don't know if we want to put an address on here. And I'd like to pull out of the driveway because I smell gasoline and he won't let me in. Operator, you want to pull out of the driveway because you smell gasoline but he won't let you in?
Yes, that is what I said.
Social worker, he won't let me in. Operator, He won't let you out of the driveway. Social worker. He won't let me in the house. Operator. Whose house is it? Social worker. He's got the kids in the house and he won't let me in. It's a supervised visit. Operator. I understand. Whose house is it? Social worker. Josh Powell. Operator. Okay, you don't live there, right? Social worker. No, no. I'm contracted to the state to provide supervised visitation. Operator. I see. Okay. And who is there to exercise the visitation? Social worker. I am. And the visit is with Josh Powell, and he's the husband of operator. And who's supervising? Social worker. I supervise.
Oh my gosh.
Operator. So you supervise and you're doing the visit. You supervise yourself.
I'm going to lose my mind. Who's this operator?
Social worker. I supervise myself. I'm the supervisor here. Operator, wait a minute. If it's a supervised visit, you can't supervise yourself if you're the supervisor, if you're the visitor. Worker, I supervise myself. I'm the supervisor for a supervised visit. Operator, okay, but you aren't the one making the visit? Or is there another parent there you're supervising? Social worker, I'm the one that supervises. I pick up the kids at their grandparents. Operator, yes, and then who visits the children? Social worker, Josh Powell. Operator, okay, so you're supposed to be there to supervise Josh Powell's visit with his children? Social worker, yes, that's correct.
How long did this take?
Yes, that's correct. And he's the husband of missing Susan Powell. This is a high-profile case. Operator, how did he gain access to children before you got there? Social worker, I was one step in back of them. Operator, so they went into the house and he locked you out? Social worker, yes, he shut the door right in my face. Operator, all right, now it's clear. Your last name? Operator.
Like, what the heck? By this time, like, forget about it. They're gone.
And what agency are you with? Social worker, Foster Care Resource Network. And the kids have been in there now, by now approximately 10 minutes.
It took that long?
And he knows this is a supervised visit. Operator, how many children? Social worker, 2. Brayden is 5 and Charlie is 7. Operator, and the dad's last name? Social worker, Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L. Operator, 2 L's? 2 L's at the end of Powell? Social worker, yes.
Who is this person? Did they
Operator,
get fired?
His first name? Social worker. His first name is Josh. Operator, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, Native? Social worker, he's white. Operator, date of birth? Social worker, I don't know, he's about 39. No. Operator, how tall? Social worker, 5'10", 150 pounds. Operator, hair color? Social worker, brown. Operator, did you notice what he was wearing? Social worker, no, I didn't notice what he was wearing. Operator, is he alone? Social worker, I don't know, I couldn't get in the house. Operator, are you in the vehicle now or are you on foot? Social worker, I'm in a vehicle. I'm in a Prius, a 2010 Prius. The door is locked. He hasn't opened the door. I rang the doorbell and everything. I begged him to let me in. Operator, please listen to my question. What color is the Toyota Prius? Social worker, gray, dark gray. Operator, and the license number? Social worker, I don't know. I can look.
There's Operator, no way all of this stuff matters.
All right, we'll have somebody look for you there. Social worker, okay, how long will it be? Operator, I don't know, ma'am. They have to respond to emergency life-threatening situations first.
Oh my gosh.
The first available deputy will respond. Social worker, this could be life-threatening. He went to court on Wednesday and he didn't bring his kids back. And this is really, I'm afraid for their lives. Operator, okay. Has he threatened their lives, the lives of the children previously? Social worker, I have no idea. Operator, all right. Well, we'll have the first available deputy contact you. Social worker, thank you. Operator, bye.
This is so ridiculous. I hope that operator got freaking fired.
The house then went up in explosive flames. When the boys' bodies were discovered, they both had chopping marks on their heads.
What the heck?
After incapacitating them, Josh poured gas over them before lighting the fire. Ultimately, smoke inhalation killed Josh, Charlie, and Brayden. So they were still alive when they went up in flames. The entire house was ablaze. You can see pictures. It went up quick and it completely burned. And the social worker watched in horror and tried to get neighbors help as she believed she could
save
the boys. So she went into shock and she went to neighbors and she said, please, there's two boys. I think we can still save them. And there was no way. So that morning, he had texted and left voicemails for family saying basically goodbye. He couldn't live without his sons and he was sorry. But no one
decided to say anything?
A lot of people said, oh, I didn't get it in time.
What?
But basically, yeah, he had given a warning. It was believed that he murdered his sons because he was worried that as they grew older, they would expose him for murdering Susan. So then the Cox family sued the state for wrongful death based on the way they handled the visitation process.
Yeah.
Their position was they put Josh's parental rights above the welfare of the children. The lawsuit was $5 million for every minute the boys were in Josh's home.
Wow.
The state position that they took the safety of the kids seriously and followed their policies. The jury found the state negligent, and this was the only form of justice the family would receive. The family didn't blame any one individual in child services. They really pointed to, we don't blame the social worker. We really just
blame the operator.
We really just blame the systems that were in place with this. That they were, the kids weren't even supposed to be in the home.
Yeah.
And there have been more issues that have come to light with that system and how it breaks down. Like, you have certain policies, but you kind of like say, oh, it's okay because it's really good for the kids to be in the parents' home.
Mm.
But obviously you're sending one woman in and he has concerning history and she can't stop that, you know?
Exactly.
Susan's body was never found and she is assumed by most to be dead.
Yeah.
And murdered by Josh. So that's kind of what everyone assumes.
Yeah.
Steven was released from prison on July.
What did Steven say?
He didn't say. He still claims that she ran away with a man.
Oh my gosh.
And this is the other thing that I don't have documented in here. So Jennifer is Josh's sister. She's very much on Susan's side. The rest of the family is completely in support of Steven and Josh. That's even so after crazy. He did this.
What the heck?
Yep. This is all Susan's fault. If she didn't run away, none of this would happen.
Oh, heck no.
Yeah. And they all don't talk to Jennifer anymore because she supported her. And
oh, heck no. Go Jennifer.
Yeah, for real. She literally, like, her family hates her now. And she's
so messed up.
Yeah.
She's better off.
For real. Steven was released from prison in July 2007 and died after a heart attack in 2018.
Whoa.
And the dispatcher from the 911 call was terminated and is now
used. Thank you.
So he, and the other thing is that you can listen to it online. Like, he's so indifferent the entire time.
Yeah, what the heck?
He literally acts like she's, like, interrupting his day. Like, he does not care.
Literally, if that would have been a faster process and somebody actually came quickly, like, that would have been a completely different situation. Because they were in there for 10 minutes, like.
Right, yeah, exactly. So he was terminated, and that call is now used nationwide as an example of what not to do on their onboarding training. So they literally use that call and say, here's what not to do.
Literally.
And so he has spoken out, and he's basically said, I was just doing my job. I did what I was trained to do. Like,
so then it's a training thing?
No.
But it's also a, like, common sense thing of, this sounds like an emergency, dude.
Well, this is the thing. You're not trained to miss details. So when she opens the call saying, I'm at Josh Powell's house, you don't ask 10 minutes later, what's the name? You're supposed to have all
this
that.
This literally sounds like a customer service for, like, a random website. Like,
if he was paying attention and listening to keywords, like, he would have gotten it. And he did say, like, I missed some key things she said. But
clearly,
he doesn't really take responsibility for it. She feels the
most
guilty.
But also, like, she literally said, no, I do think this is a matter of life and death.
Yeah, like, and she feels like she basically thinks it's her fault. And it's really awful. And the that's why the family was like, we don't blame her and we're not going after her at all. We just blame the systems that allowed them to get into
that
home.
She did the right thing. She called
911. It wasn't, the dispatcher wasn't at fault enough for them to go after it. Like, they're very protected.
Mm.
And so it would have to be such blatant, like, you hear in the background someone getting murdered and they're like,
how do you get a job as a 911 dispatcher?
I don't think it's super hard.
It's just interesting. I've never met or heard of anybody.
It's bad hours.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
I guess you could have a day shift, but
it just depends, like, probably seniority. But I've just never met anybody who's had that job.
I think it's probably a job where you, I don't remember what I was going to say. I was literally like, it'll come back to me. Nope, it's not coming back to me.
It's just interesting. I would like to talk to somebody who has that job to see what their experience is like.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say. I think it's probably a job where it's really boring calls and then there's really crazy calls.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you're sitting there and it's like,
until you get something.
Okay, like, I'll send someone for your chest pain. Then it's like nothing.
Yeah.
And then, okay, I'll send someone for your noisy neighbor, whatever. Yeah. And then.
Well, and that's the thing too. It's like, if you're on the job for like a year, right? And you only get these boring calls and you're like, it's never going to happen. And then you get a call like that. And the social worker is probably not freaking out. She's like trying to, it seemed like she was trying to speak calmly. So
she
in your
very,
mind.
She very, very like, flustered. Like you could tell
that she was,
it was not a good situation. And that's the big thing that people point to. There was key things she said of like, it's a high profile case.
Yeah.
It's a missing woman. His wife is missing. Like even if, and he goes to like, do you know if he's ever hurt the kids? Like none of that matters.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be inside with the kids by himself. That's the biggest thing that.
Oh, this guy.
Yeah. So Poor dude. I mean, he literally acted like he was like answering a call while he's like at his wedding.
Yeah.
Like, how dare you interrupt me right now?
That's horrible.
So.
Wow. That's a crazy story.
Crazy story.
That's like so many things. Like
I know it goes one direction
Steven thing and then like
there's a whole there's podcasts about it, like there's a lot of content and information, and even with like the church, they go towards the end, they go through this whole thing where they kind of like stop being a part of that and kind of like don't really practice it anymore and kind of are just over it. And so that's a big thing too, like Josh too, like he likes the traditions of it when it came to like household roles and like what it gave him.
Not
but
surprised.
The faith part of it, he was like, no.
Yeah, not surprised at all.
Yeah, so I think Steven's gonna do some.
Yeah, we're not alone this time. Finally, crazy. We've been alone for the past like three.
Oh, Jan and Steven are gonna
three
do
episodes.
It. Cool. Okay, so I just looked it up and something new has happened as far as the dispatcher goes.
Oh.
So he's now come around and said, like, he was really, like, neglectful in his behavior. Mm-hmm. And now he basically trains dispatchers in what's called compassion fatigue, where you get, like, really numb to things and just kind of, like, don't really care.
So that's what he
so
said.
He's come around to, mm-hmm. So he's coming around to, and he was a little bit older, so I'm sure he'd heard a lot of crazy stuff, which is good to hear that he, like.
Yeah, that's good that he recognizes it and is like, you know what, like, let me help people not do what I just did.
Yeah. All right, what you hoes got?
You asked for it.
You talking to me? True or false, is there a dinosaur park in Washington?
A what?
Dinosaur park. The answer is true.
Okay.
There is a dinosaur park. It's called Heisey Park, and it's a great spot for children to experience.
So I'm assuming that they like checked that place.
That's what I'm assuming.
Body, right?
I would assume.
Smart thing to do.
Yeah. So, you know, there was that, and then also just a little bit of a deep dive on the origin of Mormonism. So Mormons are a religious and cultural group related to Mormonism. The principal branch of the Latter-day Saints movement started by Joseph Smith in upstate New York during the 1820s, in case you didn't know that.
Interesting, yeah. I would not expect that to be New York.
Me neither. I did not know that. After Smith's death in 1844, the movement split into several groups following different leaders.
Ah, so that's when they moved to
the majority Utah. Followed Brigham Young. Yes. While smaller groups followed Joseph Smith III, Sidney Rigdon, and James Strang. And if you split the country in half, you know, you take Texas and just go straight up, anything east of that is making up 2% or less of Mormons. Anything west of that is a much, much larger group. I don't know what's so funny.
I'm just laughing.
But yeah, if you look at Utah, about 55% of Mormonism. So just some interesting facts about Mormonism and its origins.
And it's interesting. On the east side, it's really just Maine and the Virginias, right?
The Virginias, correct.
I thought it was the Carolinas.
No,
it's the Virginias.
Ah, okay.
intimate knowledge as to where the Mormons live. No. I thought yeah, I was the Carolinas.
I know everything.
What you got, Jan?
Oh, hey. So you talked about how this guy had like these porn cartoons. I do yes, think it's funny though.
Yes, tell us more about the animated porn.
I was actually wondering if you knew which cartoons, because I was actually really curious.
He said SpongeBob.
No, they said.
Oh no, it's just Nickelodeon.
Nickelodeon.
Oh, okay.
I just assumed SpongeBob is like the biggest Nickelodeon.
Sandy Cheeks.
I would not be surprised.
Sandy Cheeks.
I feel like a lot of them weren't family though. It's incestuous.
Oh, they did say that. Yeah.
So like
Fairly Odd Parents.
It had to be like Jimmy Neutron or something.
I don't want to think about this, guys.
Jimmy Neutron and Carl.
Oh,
anyways,
I don't like that.
Family.
Yeah, they're
probably
like
had something though.
Oh.
All I can think about was Michael Scott. When they have the Mickey Mouse and
the watermark.
Oh,
the watermark. And he's sitting, I love the line when he says, he goes, I mean, by the looks of it, it's consensual, so.
Oh,
yes. Guys, that's
funny.
Funny. Anyways, you talked about that sex test interview thing.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My comment was, what if you're attracted to the interviewer?
Oh no. Yeah, bad day.
You're screwed. You're like, no, I promise I don't like that stuff. But anyways, actually it was like I was curious as to what happens in one. And so I started Googling it, and then most of the articles like what, like how to take this test and like
how
lawyers,
to pass it.
How to pass it. And it was
oh,
like
no,
what you can expect coming for your test. And I was like, oh, now Google thinks
oh,
I got one
no,
of these.
Dan's gonna have some interesting ads
yeah,
coming up soon.
They're gonna be but knocking anyways, on your door soon. Like
I was, yeah, I was interested to see like what the test entailed, and entailed, pun intended. It was four sections: a clinical interview, a psychometric test, a psychological assessment of sexual arousal, and a risk assessment. The first one's like an icebreaker. It's just a clinical interview, serves as an icebreaker. This is between the evaluator and the client. They ask like family history, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Any intimacy, relationship history, et cetera, et cetera. Second one is a personality interview with which consists of 154 item object psychological tests.
Oh my gosh.
Et cetera, et cetera. It's designed to identify psychopathic individuals, a sexual inventory, which is a thorough assessment of the client's sexual history. So sort of then this is where it gets interesting. A psychological assessment helps the evaluator determine whether the allegations against the client is likely to reoccur. This is typically determined by using, and might I say this is very sexist, but they only talk about men. but I mean, let's be real, most of them are committed by men.
I mean, I feel like it's probably just that happens more.
Yeah, for sure, 100%. I was making a joke. This is typically determined by using penile plethysmography. And I Googled, I was like, what the
oh,
frick is that?
No.
I Googled that. What is whatever? plethysmography measures changes in volume in different oh, areas of your body.
Interesting.
They have an erection test.
Oh,
so that's
no,
what they do. They basically, along with the client's breathing and introverted, they just like show them stuff. And then
yikes,
there's also a polygraph test at that point. And then the last one is a risk assessment, whether or not the person thinks they'll do it again.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I'm just like, just think practically about being the person conducting this interview.
Oh, no, I would not want to
like,
be doing that.
Like, if they have like two or three people back there, 100% they're putting like bets on what's going to be. They're like, do you
oh,
think it's
sure,
slide 14 of Mickey Mouse? Or do you think it's slide 34 of the one girl? It's just like, just, I just think like sometimes we hear
so
these
weird
stories of these things, but you don't think about like what it's like to do that every day. Like
yeah,
that's just weird. Can you imagine? This is weird.
That is weird.
Anyways, thanks. I'm so happy to be back. It's been a crazy time to not be a part of this podcast.
Honestly, we've done a pretty good job though.
You guys
ourselves,
have killed it. Like, makes me feel like I'm not useful.
Yikes. No, that's not true.
But anyways, Steven, what should the listeners do?
They should email us at shotofcrime@gmail.com and
yeah,
tune in next week for another exciting edge of your seat story.
Oh, I have to give you a topic if you
oh,
want to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah. What you giving me?
Something involving a car.
A car?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It gives you a wide range of things.
Yeah.
Buckle your seatbelts.
That was really good.